Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today's Wednesday. It's December 21, and we're beginning a new chapter in the history of the radio station. We're going to be talking to none other than our new host, Jose Roman, who's going to inaugurate the first broadcast that will be heard once a month in discussion over the future of Puerto Rico. So the question is, will Puerto Rico seek statehood or independence? It was on December 17th that the House of Representatives passed the first ever binding referendum in 142 years to either allow the United States to permit Puerto Rico to become the 51st state or gain independence. And so the referendum was named the Puerto Rico Status Act. So let's first say hello to Jose. Good morning.
Good morning, Jesse. Buenos dias.
Buenos dias to you. Well, it seems like right away we have a call, so we'll find out who that caller is, and we'll both entertain him or her. Good morning, caller. Thanks for waiting.
Déjame decirte, espérate.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yes, hello. You can speak Spanish or English, whatever you like.
It's Spanish because I want to hear what he say. Okay.
Okay, so, he's going to speak in English, but you speak to her, Jose.
I think she just wants to listen to the show.
Okay, I'll leave the show. I'll leave in English. Exactly. Okay.
Okay, very good.
Thank
you. So it seems they, for the first time ever in, 140-some-odd years since the Spanish-American War, that Puerto Rico has been permitted by the New York State as the Federal Assembly, to actually, if they vote according to what they want, it will impact the government, and the government can't say no. So if they want independence, that has to be agreed to. It's agreed to in advance, and so on and so forth. So this is a huge step for only part of the government, because the Senate hasn't approved this yet. So what's going on there? I don't get that.
Basically, what they're doing is, this bill was approved by the Congress, but it has to be ratified, has to be approved as well by the Senate, which most likely is not going to be approved because, according to most of the people, all the analysts and everyone else, they feel that the Senate is not going to approve it because of the filibuster, that they need 60 votes, and the Democrats don't have the 60 votes. So that means that it's going to be hanged, in the Senate.
So is it conceivable since the Senate is going to become a majority Republican in a couple of weeks, could not the Senate, if they wanted to, vote now before it becomes a Republican majority? So are they playing a game here?
They still need the 10 extra votes, and they don't have it. I mean, the 10 extra votes will require, the Republicans to vote on in favor of it, and the majority of them, they are opposing to that. They don't want a nation where they have the idiosyncrasy and they have the Spanish language be another...
Well, it's really quite tragic. But were you... Go ahead.
We're talking about if Puerto Rico becomes a statehood, you're talking about two extra senators that most likely will be Democrats. And also, we talk about 4 to 5 representatives from Puerto Rico.
Yes.
So the balance of power is going to be shift again.
So maybe that's why the Senate won't approve it at the moment, and may not approve it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that fit into the history of Puerto Rico? Because Puerto Rico has not been able to move forward.
Okay. So that's a good question. That's a good question because I would like to give a little background about why United States and Puerto Rico enter in this relationship of colonialism. Okay. So we have to way back to 1898, where the United States invaded Puerto Rico in 1988. First of all, the first thing they did was they bombarded San Juan in May of 1988, and with like 12, battleships. And secondly, they occupied Puerto Rico with 16,000 troops in order to invade it and establish a military government. But that's prior to the Spanish-American War, that they, according to all the stories, if we remember that the reason why the United States got involved into the war with the American, Spanish-American War was because of the sinking of the ship in the Havana Harbor. And that was way back in the early 1898. But that was very suspicious. And also, there's a lot of issues that it's very suspicious how come that ship was sunk. So I think that was the reason why they got, that was the excuse that they used in order to get involved into this American Spanish War. And so that triggered the involvement of the United States into all of these issues with Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and also we have to remember
though there are a lot of issues. Supposedly the U.S. government is going to extend Medicaid funding. I only heard the last day or two because they were going to actually stop it. Why is it so difficult if we have control, if the United States has control over Puerto Rico for 120 some odd years, why is it still a problem? Why do they treat Puerto Rico like it was, like garbage at times? It just seems not right.
Because we are the definition of the classic colonial nation, the metropolis. What does the metropolis do in the colonies? They take the prime material, they take all the resources, and they use it on their behalf. And they import it back to Puerto Rico. For instance, Puerto Rico, we take the highest electricity. We consume 90% of what we consume come from the United States. We have to use the United States merchant, in order to bring all the products to Puerto Rico, which is the highest, the most expensive one in the whole world. And we pay 40% extra in order to bring the products to Puerto Rico. That means that the inflation in Puerto Rico is skyrocketing. Puerto Rico is in a very precarious situation, economically situation, because of all of this. Because that's symptomatic to the relationship of the colonialism in Puerto Rico, and most people don't understand that. But that's clear.
Does the prospect of statehood or independence for Puerto Rico, which this time, however the vote goes, will have to be accepted by the federal government? Because that's what the islanders want, so they will have to abide by the final vote. But is it cheaper to import through other countries and using other vessels? So why are we charging so much?
Yeah, we will be saving 40% of the expenses if we can use a foreign. If we can go out in the global market, which is supposed to be this global, market, we can go and get the best, the better bid.
Okay.
We can do that. And we will be, in better, position than we are now. As you mentioned this is the first, in regards to this bill, this is the first time that this bill recognize the Commonwealth is it's a colon, a colonial status in Puerto Rico, first time ever.
Right.
And also
first time
stating that is it's going to be Biden, that they have to, United States has to honor it.
Accept the final vote.
And also, in regards to this, we're talking about, we have had this referendum. This is, we have 8 referendums already, and this is going to be the 9th one.
Right. But this is the first one that's binding, so that makes a big difference, doesn't it?
It does make a big difference, yes.
Yeah. One thing I want to ask you, is it conceivable that the island can financially become viable without the United States, especially if it's going to be saving money by contracting other shipping companies from around the world to for whatever goods that they need imported?
It does have the potential to do it, like any other nation.
Uh-huh.
Like, take, for instance, the Dominican Republic. That's a booming economy in the Caribbean. To other countries, take for instance, a lot of islands in the Caribbean, as well as people,
absolutely, they're doing very well.
In South America, yes, we do. But the issue is that we have to diversify our economy, and because we are a colony, so what we do is, for instance, throughout the invasion and the domination of the United States, we have always fulfilled the needs of the metropolis. So we started from mono agriculture of the sugar cane early centuries, because that's what the United States needed.
Right.
After that, it became the clothing, and the clothing, and after that, it became the, you can see throughout the years that based upon the needs of the metropolis, that's what we respond. So our economy hasn't been diversified because of that, but we have the potential to do it. We have the manpower, we have the skills, and so on. So it can be done.
Okay.
It's like they are selling us that fallacy that it cannot be done, that we are impotent, that without the United States we won't be able to survive, and that's a fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
We can.
Right. Well, we used to have a lot of companies, particularly in pharmaceuticals, that had big company operations in Puerto Rico, but somehow, and I don't know why, they eventually closed up, but they were able to get subsidies and funding in Puerto Rico. So I don't know why they left. They probably got some better deal somewhere else, so they leave.
No, the reason was that they would get a very lucrative incentive from the from the Puerto Rico government, that Puerto Rico will provide all the infrastructure, all the incentive, and so on, and they won't leave any money there. All the money will be going to the mainland. And secondly, what they have left behind is a lot of environmental contamination.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Right, they
people
never cleaned up
from cancer and all that, because they are highly contaminated. And also they've been using the aquifers, the water from the
aquifers,
the aquifers, they've been using it up because they need a lot of water. And Puerto Rico doesn't have, the environmental laws in Puerto Rico, they are very weak. That's why they established in Puerto Rico. That's why at one point Puerto Rico used to be called the capital of the pharmaceuticals in the whole world. Because of the percentage per capita there. So that's an illustration why we are a colony, that's what they needed at that point, and that's what the pharmaceuticals, they were there, because there was cheap labor, and they don't have to deal with the side effects of the consequences of have been there for the pollution of the environment. So that describes you how the colonies work.
I was surprised years ago when there was the potential of Puerto Rico being the hub for the expansion of internet services beyond Puerto Rico into the Caribbean, and that never took place. Is that a potential development for Puerto Rico when it becomes independent to be able to
definitely
be replaced?
Yes. Also, one of the reasons why the United States got involved in Puerto Rico earlier was because of our geopolitical position. We are in the middle
yes.
of the two Americas. So it's
correct.
Very easy to get there and to expand all over the two continents. That's the
yes.
primary reason that we're there, military as well as economic. So we
mm-hmm.
have that. We can explore that. We can, we can develop all of that because we have it.
What about the people that, for example, New York has a large Puerto Rican community of residents that are now live in New York. We've got representatives in Congress as well that are supportive mm-hmm. of Puerto Rico. Do you think we can count on these people to help Puerto Rico with work out a good deal?
Yeah, we can. As a matter of fact, this project was originated from the representatives from
New York.
From New York. Media
yeah.
as well as AOC.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They took a very important role. I mean, I applaud them for that. They took the courage, and they did not get intimidated or felt afraid of it,
mm-hmm.
and they went ahead.
Yeah.
We have to give them credit for that. This is a stepping stone.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, more has to come. This is not a perfect bill. It has to be modified because they're still including
yeah.
what they call a free association. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
It means that, it's going to give a little more power to the Commonwealth and it will be called free association. No. It should be a statehood or independence. Nothing in between.
And what do you think? Do you feel that the islanders, the people who live there now, who would be able to vote on statehood or independence, do you believe that they can overcome over some 120 some odd years of, being a colony of the United States? Or do you think they're looking for independence? Is there a fear to becoming independent, or is there a hope to become independent?
Well,
or do
most
we
people,
know?
The majority of people, they are afraid because of what we've been the propaganda from the metropolis that
right.
we are helpless and we won't be able to survive by ourselves. But remember that the second market of the United States in the whole hemisphere is Puerto Rico. So this is not,
yes.
They give us money, but they take money away from us a lot of money.
Right.
So it's not only one, that the allegation of the Republicans is that, we give a lot of incentive allocation of money to Puerto Rico, but they don't look back into the economy that, and one example of that would be remember the PROMESA, which is the fiscal control. The reason that they established that is in order to cut the benefits of Puerto Rico, to cut the health benefits, to cut
yeah,
the pensions in Puerto Rico, and all of that
yeah.
because the main priority was to pay Wall Street, Wall Street people of the money
mm-hmm.
that Puerto Rico has been taking us, with the bonds and all that. That we have
mm-hmm.
paid that debt. We have paid that debt four times already, and they still want more and more and more. So these are
mm-hmm.
the big economical interests that they are coming to play, that they are more important
okay.
for the, for the capitalism to get the money and forget about how we're struggling and surviving.
So the challenge, I guess, now, since the vote, when it will, I don't know exactly when the vote would take place, but when the vote takes place, can the islanders of Puerto Rico and the citizens that want to be there and live there, do you think that they, can they be informed of the potential of the island and how they can actually do well as a nation?
Yes, you know, it can be informed, but if you look at the, I was reading briefly the bill
that you posted,
I was reading briefly. Well, they are talking about having a referendum in May of next year. That's not enough time to educate people.
No,
so,
it's not.
So that's
what I was worried about.
That's a kind of disservice as you see it. That they is, you know, meant to be falling apart.
Yeah,
so
it's like an illusion. It says one thing, but then it doesn't act like to give people an opportunity to make a logical conclusion and of how to vote. So it's hard to erase over 100 and some odd years of history overnight when you only have a few months. Well, nobody probably is even going to be paying attention now at the end of December, and if it's in a 3 months' time, it's going to be impossible to tell. Is that one of the challenge of people who support Puerto Rico independence or statehood?
It's one of the challenges. And the other challenge that we haven't spoken about is that are the people in the diaspora going to be able to vote?
Yes. Yeah,
so
I was wondering about that myself.
Yeah, we're talking about 5 million Puerto Ricans in the diaspora.
Yeah.
You know, they're almost, you know, we are like, you know, almost two times Puerto Ricans out of the Puerto Rican mainland that they reside in the United States.
Yes, two times as much.
And those people are being bombarded with the American way of life. They don't reside in Puerto Rico. They reside here because of the exodus of the, due to the economic crisis in Puerto Rico. They didn't want to leave. They've been forced to leave.
And so people who
were
forced to leave and are now part of the diaspora in the United States, should they have a right to vote? It would make sense that they should, because they may want to go back to their homeland.
They should have the right to vote.
Well, they were uprooted.
Yeah, but that's very vague, you know. It would be, the fourth generation Puerto Rican? So that has to be lined out. Who would the criteria to make it equitable, to make it, you know, something that would make
equitable
sense to the Puerto Rican there?
Yes.
So it could be the father or the mother of Puerto Rican who would be the right to vote, or what is it? Who's going to establish that?
That's a good question, a very good question. So a lot
and
of
also,
questions are up
also
in the air, and
mention.
They're unknown.
Something I want to mention is that instead of going through all of these, you know, bills, the bill is pretty good, you know, at least acknowledge that we are a colony, you know, nationwide, which has been ratified by the United Nations under the Resolution 1514, has been ratified for the last, since the 60s, that Puerto Rico is a colony. But, and most of the, in the General Assembly, you know, usually 180 or 190 countries vote in favor of that. So the consensus among most of the countries is that we are still a colony, and the United States never wanted to recognize it until now. And people can look at it.
Can I ask you a question? Can you appreciate why the attitude has changed in the United States with regard to Puerto Rico, especially with the Assembly, with the Congress? Why did they do that?
It's changing because of international pressure that the United has been subjected to. It's not because they want to do it. It's because of pressure. I mean, we've been galvanizing all the independence movement as well as the statehood movement on behalf of having a status definition, finally.
Okay.
So before it was fragmented, now it becomes organizing. Like the independent groups, that there are many of them, they've been united, you know, claiming for a solution, that this is, you know, unbearable, that they have to do something about it. It's not because they want to do it. You know, the metropolis never wants to leave, you know, the colonies. No, they got to fight for it.
No. Yeah.
But
and do you think
I want
that-
to bring.
Go ahead. What issue do you want to bring up? You're more important.
Yes, I want to bring that, this bill is pretty good because recognize that we are colony, that the Congress recognizes. But instead of doing this bill, it's, most of the people on the left, people that they believe in independence, we believe that we should have, instead of all of this, we should have a constituent assembly.
What is that?
That means, a constituent assembly for the status, meaning that all the powers would be, that this assembly would be elected by the people of Puerto Rico, and we will have a united voice to claim what we want to do with Puerto Rico, and then after that, take it to a vote. Not the way they're doing it. No, this would be the right way. That the people will select the delegates, and the delegates will go to negotiate with the Congress what really wants, and then we will take it to a vote. But in the interim, all the powers will be transferred to this constituency assembly, so it won't be no kind of interference with the United States, power brokers.
What about the power brokers in Puerto Rico that have not been promoting independence or statehood for a very long time? They haven't been there 100 years, but they're still part of the power structure, no?
Yeah. Well, as we know, they are just administrators of the colony.
Yeah. Right.
So they administrate the colony and they get benefits out of it. They don't want any status quo change. They want to have the same status quo. So they're happy.
Yeah.
Impunity is rampant.
Absolutely.
The same thing. Friends and family, those are the ones that they get the better jobs. All the scandals and so forth. It's a synonymous of the neoliberal, policies.
Well, got to ask you, so even though there are many obstacles ahead, the prospect of something positive coming out of this, even though we're not sure how to go about it at the moment, and we don't know how the people from Puerto Rico will want to cast their vote, what they feel comfortable with, if it should fail by March, can this continue? Or does it probably will energize a lot of people who say, oh my gosh, we can do this.
Yes, we
and
can.
Other people,
like you said,
might be fearful, but maybe that can change over time.
I hope
we don't have to wait another 100 years. I'll be dead by then.
And also, having a forum like we have it now, discussing the issues that most people, they are unfamiliar with. This is a step in the right direction in order to people to have the both sizes, to learn about it, learn about the history of why we are in this predicament now. It was not because of our choice. It was because it was imposed. The reason why, fiscal control board is there, it's because way back in 1900, they enacted the Foraker law, which allows the United States to do all of this. But most people don't know that. We couldn't, declare bankruptcy because of that law. Like Detroit did. Detroit, declared bankruptcy and they reassessed the whole, infrastructure and look at what they're doing. We couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, the Jones Law, 1917, where we were granted citizenship. Well, with ulterior reason that we would be fighting the First World War One.
Yeah.
And proportionally, more Puerto Ricans died there than any other people of the United States. The second thing with the, you know, Second World War II. So there's always an ulterior reason.
So why was such rich history and so much that wasn't right about how America treated Puerto Rico? Why don't we know more? Is this part of, like, it's like a whitewash. It's like, you know, it's like to cover it all up.
Yes,
or is
they
it
did.
The Americans,
I mean,
just don't know much
well.
About history.
You know, all the issues that I've been brought to your attention, we don't learn it in school. In the history of Puerto Rico, they don't mention them. You know, they say that the United States came to Puerto Rico to save us from the Spaniards, from the Spanish people.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
they omit that before the invasion, we have gained an autonomous status with the Spaniards.
Yes.
We had, you know, as a matter of fact, we even had our own money before the United States came there. And what they did, the United States, when it came there, they devalued the money to 90%. So that was they were able to buy all the land, Puerto Rico, and create all of these haciendas for the sugar cane.
Uh-huh.
Everything was orchestrated. It doesn't come from nowhere.
Yeah.
Even the intervention in Cuba, it was orchestrated since 1894. In order to stop the revolution in Cuba, and get rid of Spain out of this hemisphere. That's why Spain lost Philippines. They lost, they lost Cuba. They lost Guam. They got, you know, they lost the Marshall Islands. They lost, you know, the Mariana Islands. Guam and all that.
Yes.
It was a win-win situation. With the so-called sinking of the U.S. Main, you know. Shit.
Yes.
So this is a piece of history that we have to learn. And
but
that's what we're here for.
Do you think that, which is, I'm very grateful that, first of all, you have this knowledge, because most people don't, an understanding, and you speak the language, which is also very important. There isn't like an overwhelming desire for, in the United States, probably to see Puerto Rico depart the country. But it's not like they're an enemy. It just seems like the island would be a tremendous boon as far as tourism is concerned from all over the world. And also from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We are not
expecting to be United States enemy. We can, you know, we can collaborate. We can have, you know, trade pacts. We can, you know, exchange ideas and all that. But with mutual respect. We want the respect that we deserve.
Absolutely.
We want to be able to have our own republic. We want to be able to determine our own destiny without any interference of any foreign country. That's what we want.
Mm-hmm.
To do.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's
sense.
The way. That's
what about,
the way it should be.
What about what? Like one of the difficulties might be also changing the value of money. Would Puerto Rico create its own money?
Yeah. Yeah,
or it could
will.
Be aligned with anybody else, too, if they wanted to, right? They could always adopt
it can be
anybody's
great.
Currency. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the currency. And
okay.
Yeah, we can get the currency, yes. But that's, you know, that's down the line. You know, that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of issues that we have to deal with. But it can be done. It's like we have to take the first step, which is become an independent nation.
Right.
Be able to have, you know, our own rights and be able to have, you know, be able to determine our destiny with respect and be part of the nation, you know, the the nations, you know, the global nations as a
exactly.
not as a colony.
Do you know any of the people who have a Puerto Rican heritage in the United States that are in government? Do you know what their perspective is with regard to a Puerto Rican independence or statehood? And why would anybody want to become a state of the United States particularly? Why is that an attractive offer, or is it?
Because
becoming a state.
Because as we spoke before, we have been, you know, indoctrinated with this policy that we have to be part of the so-called best nation of the world, that this is where the American dream comes through. For some people, no, not a lot of people.
I don't know. I really don't think it's that of a positive, if you must know. You know, not mm-hmm. not every state in the union is doing well. Let's face
no.
it. So, you know, it's not like you look at all 50 states and you say, oh, they're all the majority of them are doing better than anybody else. No, they're not.
And you look at the reason why, you know, this exodus of Puerto Ricans migrating to the United States because of the economic crisis in Puerto Rico. Otherwise, they were still there. We want to remain, you know, people want to remain there. You know, those are our roots. And, you know, we, like, for whatever reason, we're still here and we decided to come and, you know, for a short time, but we still have the link with Puerto Rico. I go 4 times a year to Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm involved in politics.
And you have family there, too.
And I have family there, yes. I was the only one who came.
Yeah.
But I haven't disengaged myself from my heritage. I still believe that that's the solution.
Well, I think language is a very important aspect of wanting to be in a nation where they speak the language. In America, they barely speak language other than English. And they don't speak it that well in English sometimes either. I think I'm a foreigner myself. I think I speak better English than most people. My first language. But but whatever the case is, I think language is very, very important. And heritage is important. And customs and traditions that are still alive and have not been expunged or lost because of the takeover of the island since the Spanish-American War by the Americans.
Right. Listen, and that's another issue, that Puerto Rico, they were banned to speak their own language from 1988 to almost the middle of the 40s. The English was the official language. Because I struggle. I remember my mother. My mother used to sing, you know, without knowing English. She used to sing all of those little songs in English very fluently.
Yeah.
Because she was she was forced to learn them in school.
Uh-huh.
That's how they want to indoctrinate
Puerto Ricans into English. So they would lose their connection with language.
Yes.
Which makes no sense.
Yeah, but that's the link. You know, the language is a link.
Yeah, that was the link
to
break
by
the link.
To be bilingual and cultural is a big link.
Yeah.
But I remember that, you know, historically, I remember my mother singing those songs. I said, how do you know that? She said, well, I was forced in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So basically it was abolished in the 40s, you know, after that.
Puerto Rico, I think, would do very well because all of South America speaks Spanish. So much of the Caribbean islands speak Spanish. A few places don't. It doesn't matter. But I think it would be a welcome to all of the Spanish-speaking world in the Southern Hemisphere that we look forward to Puerto Rico being independent, I would think. Don't you?
Yes, I believe so. I believe so. And also, yeah, besides that, at this point in life, I mean, at this stage, you know, in this century, a lot of Puerto Ricans are, you know, are able to communicate in English as well. So they are.
Oh, of course. They are.
By virtue of being the colony, so.
Yeah.
Which is a plus.
So that should give a leg up to a lot of places where they only speak Spanish and don't speak any English at all.
Exactly.
And so that would work well. And what do you think about Spain itself? Do you think Spain would gravitate also to resuscitating a different relationship with Puerto Rico?
I don't know about
certainly not from 100 years ago.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, they were the invaders for 400 years, so we don't have any good, you know, and they were the responsible for the genocide of the Puerto Ricans, indigenous people, to raping the
Absolutely.
You know, the to raping and killing and abusing and enslaving the indigenous people. So we will not have, you know, good, you know.
Well,
good,
it's very interesting because that the history of the Spanish is the same history as the French, and the same history as the Dutch, and the same history as the Belgians, and all of those countries, there may be others, the Germans too, forgot to mention them, in South Africa and so on. All those countries are now starting to apologize in the last few years for the atrocities that they created. It can't be condoned. It needs to be recognized as a failure, even though it was common among the big colonial powers. And it really is amazing that so few nations stood up and said, no, this isn't right. And it took 400 years to get there. It really is amazing.
I never heard any official from Spain acknowledging the atrocities.
No, they haven't done it yet. They haven't done it. The Spanish have
they
not done,
done
it.
It
yet. No.
And recently,
I know was it the Dutch have, the Germans have, the French, the Germans, the Dutch. The Belgians, but they didn't. Not all of them had any influence in the Caribbean or in South America. Most of it is in Africa.
But
the conduct is the same.
Yeah, but the countries that have acknowledged that, just acknowledging, but they don't have any repatriation. They are not compensating those people with all the work that they were taking away from them.
No. Most haven't. It's just words.
Yeah.
It's just words. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's
many people suffered, and they suffer even to this day.
Yeah. Okay.
That did reparations were the Germans when it came to the Jews because of World War II. The Germans have not given reparations to South Africa at all. Even though that's been pointed out, the Belgians haven't either.
But look at the case of look at the case of France with Haiti. When Haiti became the first nation in the hemisphere to become independent, in 1804. Hmm. In order to negotiate and to be acknowledged, they have to pay a tax. That cost them, millions of dollars until just recently. We're talking about before the Duvalier. I mean, during the Duvalier.
Before Duvalier, absolutely. Yep.
So
you're right.
I mean, that's an operation at the best. And nobody condoned that. There was no condemnation whatsoever.
Well, there was nobody that could speak up for them. Unfortunately, because everybody was doing the same atrocity, It didn't matter what country it was, and it was acceptable.
Yeah, that was the worst. I mean, you know, so many years paying them for what? You should be paying them.
And, but the pain continues today in Haiti.
Yeah.
Because of all of that history.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, when you think about Puerto Rico, it's quite civil in relation.
Yes. That's why you have to look at see back at the history and learn from the history and be able to analyze it and know where you are now. If you don't know history, you don't know the present and the future.
Exactly. Exactly. So the challenge is for those people who may not know the history and have not lived on the island for I don't know how many generations, is it that going to be a formidable, situation to cover? Certainly won't be able to be covered by March. How long should that take? Or can there be a major influx of news and information around the nation that would expose all that history and the potential of Puerto Rico being independent or a state?
But the good, ironically, I mean, because it's not going to pass in the Senate, we have
in
more
Senate,
time to educate the people.
Yeah, in a way, I guess doesn't really matter the March deadline because, like you said, it won't pass the Senate. That's a smart observation on your part. You're right. So it's not really a deadline that matters.
And who knows when it's going to this resolution is coming? It's going to come back because now with the Congress changing hands.
Yes.
So they might be eroded, you know, they might be gone, this bill.
Well, the bill can't be, they can eclipse this bill with a new bill. But do you think, does it make sense for the Republicans to lose whatever support they may have from the Puerto Rican diaspora in the United States? I mean, is that worth their while? To conceivably lose support?
I'm pretty sure that the hardcore, Republicans, that they are anti immigrants and all that, because people don't realize that besides, we don't need a green card to come to United States. But we've been considering, immigrants. I mean, we are not any different from any other ethnic groups when they come here. I mean, we have more rights than most people do, but, objectively, we are immigrants here because we have to adapt and be able to function in this society that is foreign to us, language as well as, culturally. And we have to deal with the same situations like most immigrants. And people don't even think about that.
Well, why is it, considering the history of the United States after the Spanish-American War and the transfer of the island to under the aegis of the United States, what's taken them so long to really incorporate the island in a better way? Why didn't it become a state? Is it because of language?
No.
Because of the color of people's skin? Where's the bias here?
I would say it's all the above, plus the economic.
Uh-huh. So before, the economics was for business, but not for the people at all.
Exactly.
So they got nothing out of it.
No. And we are a very proud nation. I mean, we still, after so many years of domination, we still have our own language. We still have considered even second and third generation of Puerto Rican descendants. You ask them who they are, and they say, I'm Puerto Rican.
Well, the language is the most important connection to any community. And if you break the language, it's over. Then there's no connection anymore.
Yeah, just look at Fifth Avenue in the Puerto Rican Day Parade.
Yes. Absolutely. And that, people that's have a, to put it,
how we are.
Well, yeah, exactly. So do you expect a tremendous upsurge of people with that are in politics who have a Puerto Rican background that would start to promote either independence or statehood, whatever? Does that make sense?
My observation is that it's going to happen. It's going to trigger more. It's going to galvanize the people to it's going to galvanize the people to be more alert and more able to be aware of the needs of Puerto Rico and fight for it.
And what about all the people who are in film and in music? They could be very instrumental, couldn't they? Because we have a very deep heritage.
That's a good example. Take for instance, Bad Bunny, which is the most known musician now in the whole world.
Yes.
And take for instance Daddy Yankee. Take for instance, Ricky Martin. When they got involved, when they got rid of the governor of Puerto Rico, Rosselló. Remember that? That was because they galvanized the whole population, and they were forced. Mm-hmm. That person to resign as a governor. The first time in history. We set a precedent in the whole, in the whole hemisphere, be able to remove someone because of the political outcry.
Yes.
So that's very important. The people that they have the power to communicate and they have the, and they are so popular among the population, crucial.
Well, I still remember movie stars like Rita Moreno, who's well known. But she's as old as I am, But
you mean
the younger generation? Yeah, exactly. But that's from my time. But there are young people now.
Yeah, but, remember Rita at that point, she was just feeling unstereotyped.
Yeah. Yeah. So
at least,
Ricky Martin is also getting up in age, but he's still a lot younger than I am. But still, there's so many people on Broadway and in music that would be very influential.
Even in sports.
And I think this would energize.
Yeah, people in sports too. We have a lot of,
sports. You're right, sports, baseball, and everything else.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We do. We have to get these people united and fighting for what we deserve, our rights.
Yeah. I think
so
this is a very encouraging moment.
Hesse, we're going to be doing this every month.
I would be thrilled if you can, because I think it makes a big difference. Because we need to inform people of the opportunities and the options. Because I think they're going to come very quick, faster than we can imagine.
Great.
But more and more people will learn, and they will know. And I think it's important to show the power behind. The potential power that could be gathered together with people in the movie industry, in the music industry, in the sports industry, and statespeople, people in government. My God, when you look at the potential for people of Puerto Rican descent, it's huge. And I think we have never celebrated that as a nation in the United States. We've always tried to push them down, which is amazing to me.
We have to embrace our achievement, in
absolutely.
All the in all the way of life, sports,
absolutely.
Music, in the academia and all that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well,
that's right. Even in academia, you're right. There are a lot of people who speak Spanish and have a Puerto Rican background. And there are other islanders as well, in the Caribbean and South America. It would probably create an upsurge of interest also in Spanish and in Spanish history,
mm-hmm.
Not just of Spain, but of the entire South America and the Caribbean. It would really open up an unbelievable panoply of history and knowledge that Americans are unaware of.
No.
And totally unfamiliar with.
Well, you know.
It would elevate people of Spanish heritage.
Yeah, you know, that's just a matter of, you know, awareness. We have to create more awareness. That's the key word.
Absolutely. And also their businesses, their big businesses that are engaged. There's now a great deal of interest, for example, to get people who to bank with banks across the nation where they speak Spanish as well, mm-hmm. and that matters.
It does.
So there's a lot of financial power behind all of this as well.
And,
what about
you know,
the people who are in government in Puerto Rico today? Do you think that they would look forward? Do they have, or are they afraid of losing power totally if it becomes independent or a state?
I think they would be leaving because they don't want to. They're not going to have the same life that they had before. You know the benefits.
They're living on high off the hog, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah, they won't be willing to work for the best interest of the population at large. They are just people that they just looking for money, and they are just looking for self-preservation and doing better for themselves. They are not thinking collectively.
Go ahead, finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they are not thinking collectively about the best way the
prospect of the
well-being of the people.
Mm, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, it is interesting. I think that since the passage of this law in the Congress this prospect, I think a lot of people will be energized, and hopefully, you know, with your input as well on the local market and hopefully more and more people will learn, and you could be at the very beginning of an avalanche of interest and of a change in what goes on with Puerto Rico. It's going to be a learning experience. It's going to be fun.
Yes, I hope that I will be, you know, at least I can contribute to a little piece of myself to be able to do that, to make that change.
I think it would be wonderful.
Very possible.
I'm honored that you made the time.
And I'm glad that you give me the opportunity to be able to do so. So you will be part of it.
Well, thank you. Well, it seems like we're at the end of the hour. I want to thank the listener who has been very patiently been on listening, and for you, of course. And we'll speak to you in about a month's time.
Yes, great. Have a great day.
All the best, sir. Thank you very much.
Happy holidays.
And Merry Christmas.
Thank you. So happy holidays for all the hours as well.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
So there we have it, folks. None other than Jose Roman. He's a political guy. He's run for office here in the city of Yonkers, and he'll be with us every month. Discussing politics, discussing history, and discussing the prospect of a future for the island of Puerto Rico, and in however the islanders decide, they will cast their vote. And you never know, with the impetus from, as he mentioned, from people in sports, people in theater, people in music, people on Broadway, and people everywhere in baseball and every conceivable athletic game in the nation, and maybe even big industry. Why not? they all have the potential of building something new, and even though it's a continuation of so much that they do, and that will be a major, major influence on the world state. And I look forward to it. It would be good. And the most important thing, you know, what I really have to do is, I personally am kosher, so I would hope that I could find a Puerto Rican cuisine that's kosher. That would really be very good. Anyway, so that's the story, and we'll speak to you next week. We'll speak to you every day. So tomorrow's Thursday, we'll have another show. And in the meantime, though, I'm going to talk about some other things that you might find of interest, and that will be, to cover other news. So bear with me a moment as I move on to the of our page, and then we'll cover some other things which will be interesting. Well, big news. It seems that the United States is going to promise Patriot missiles to Ukraine, which is unbelievable. Let's just quickly look to see what happens on the world stage on many levels. First of all, let's see what's happening with the United Nations. Evidently, the UN is easing the Democratic Republic of Congo's arms embargo. The Congolese government wants to speed up the procurement of weapons to help it fight rebel groups in the east. The United Nations also renewed its peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo for another year. So the United Nations Security Council eased an arms embargo against the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, hoping it would help the country contain the worsening security situation in the east. So under a new resolution, countries are no longer required to notify the Security Council of arms sales or military support to the Congolese government. So I've been to the Democratic Republic of the Congo myself. Unbelievably beautiful country. Anyway, an embargo was first imposed after the end of the Civil War in 2003. France is a permanent member of the Security Council, drafted the resolution, saying it was aimed at the defense of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the DRC. It was passed late on Tuesday with support from Russia and China. So the Congolese government has been complaining that the restrictions were hampering its fight against rebels, including the resurgent M23 group. Battle won, an injustice repaired, the Democratic Republic of Congo's government spokesman, Patrick Muyaya, wrote on Twitter after the resolution was passed. So France and Germany, meanwhile, became the latest parties to openly accuse Rwanda of supporting M23, one of several militant groups operating in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So during a visit to the DRC on Tuesday, French Minister of State for Development, Chrysoula Zaharopoulou, told reporters the M23 must lay down its arms and abandon the areas it occupies. Rwanda, because it must be named, must stop supporting the M23, she said. We must put an end to the repetition of history in this region. Well, German Foreign Ministry's Director for Sub-Saharan Africa, Christoph Retzlaff, tweeted that Rwanda should, quote, immediately cease, end quote, its support for the M23 and quickly contribute to a solution to the disastrous crisis. Well, after lying mostly dormant for years, the group resumed fighting late last year, making significant advances, capturing several towns and villages, including Rutshuru and Kiwanya. Well, the Congolese government blames Rwanda of supporting the M23 with troops and firepower. A United Nations group of experts found solid evidence, quote unquote, earlier this year that Kigali has supported the M23 rebel group's advance in the east. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame, speaking on the sidelines of a recent U.S.-Africa summit, however, denied his country's involvement in the fighting, saying it is, quote, Congo's problem, end quote. Well, the Security Council also on Tuesday unanimously extended the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Congo for 1 year. Natalie Broadhurst, the Deputy Permanent Representative of France to the United Nations, said that the focus would be on the robust mandate, quote-unquote, to protect civilians. The mission, known by the French acronym MONUSCO, MONUSCO, were also ordered to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate combatants and provide strategic and technical advice on reforming Congo's security sector. In July, there were deadly protests against the force, which has faced criticism for not doing enough to protect civilians from rebel attacks. MONUSCO was due to hand most of its duties over to local forces by 2024. The Security Council also ordered the peacekeepers and other United Nations staff to start preparing for the force's eventual exit from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So there's a lot going on here, and we'll try to follow and find out what's going on. One second here. Yeah, this is really important. German doctors are warning that medicine shortages will last for months. German Health Minister Karl Lauterbach has vowed new measures to boost drug supply, but health groups are skeptical that the situation will improve soon. Medical associations in Germany on Wednesday warned that the country's ongoing drug shortages are likely to persist for months. Despite new measures announced by Berlin, liquid ibuprofen and paracetamol for children are among the drugs experiencing supply chain bottlenecks. COVID-19, influenza, respiratory syncytial or syncytial virus infection, which is known as RSV, and other diseases have put a massive burden on Germany's healthcare system this winter, with children among the most infected. The same thing goes on with the United States. Well, Deutsche Welle correspondent Julia Saudelli said that many doctors and staff at the Charité Hospital in Berlin have been redirected to children's wards to combat the surge of infections. The severity of the health crisis makes ending the drug shortages an urgent issue, but medical experts fear the bottlenecks will not end anytime soon. So these are major, major problems. you know, we'll just have to see where all this goes, but it's really very problematic. Now let's quickly look here. This is really interesting because there's always a need for food. Evidently, reforms to Zimbabwe's farming system has resulted in a bumper wheat crop, and this is welcome news amid a global grain shortage. So that's something to be hopeful for, and we'll see how that goes. Bear with me a second here. So one second. This is really frightening. In Afghanistan, sorry, the Taliban is banning Afghani women from attending university. The Taliban have ordered an immediate ban on university education for women in Afghanistan. The ban is the latest in many restrictions on women's rights since the Taliban took power in 2021. And so a very frightening situation, that's for sure. And here's something interesting as well. Remember the Boris Becker? He says that he was guilty, and he admits, as he recalls, prison loneliness. The three-time Wimbledon champion has been speaking to German media for the first time since he left prison last week. In April, Becker was found guilty of concealing assets from his insolvency administrators. Tennis legend Boris Becker has recounted the moment the door of his single occupancy cell at London's notorious Wandsworth prison closed for the first time, describing the experience as the loneliest moment of his life. Becker was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison at the end of April for concealing assets worth millions from his insolvency administrators. Of course, I was guilty, he said, at the four counts he was convicted of. He faced 29 charges. The 55-year-old German broadcaster SAT1, in an interview that aired on Tuesday, that he, quote, felt hunger for the first time, end quote, during his 8 months behind bars. Sunday roast consisted of a chicken drumstick, he recalled. Becker recounted instances at Wandsworth and later at MP Hunter Combe, where some prisoners had threatened to harm him until others stepped in. But there were more heartwarming moments, such as when in November inmates organized several cakes for his birthday, Becker said. I've never experienced such solidarity in the free world, he said, adding that he planned to stay in touch with some of the people he met in jail. Becker, who was deported to his native Germany last week, said he prayed daily in the 3 weeks between his conviction and sentencing. Asked about his excitement to be finally leaving prison and coming home last Thursday, Becker said, quote, from 6 o'clock that morning, I sat on the edge of my bed and hoped the cell door would open. They came to get me at 7:30 in the morning and asked, are you ready? I said, let's go. I had already packed everything beforehand. Becker shot to tennis stardom as a 17-year-old winner of Wimbledon in 1985 before retaining his title a year later. In January of 1991, he reached world number one and went on to win 6 majors in his career. He won a 3rd Wimbledon title in 1989, beating a great rival, Stefan Edberg, and he also won the Australian Open twice, as well as the U.S. Open title. He retired from the sport in 1999 and has since worked in the media. Becker was Novak Djokovic's coach for 3 years until 2016 and has been a regular commentator for the BBC at Wimbledon, as well as for Eurosport for other tournaments. Under the terms of his release, Becker is not allowed to return to the United Kingdom, where his son still resides. Organizers of the annual Berlinale said that Tuesday that next year's film festival will feature the premiere of a documentary about Becker, while the German Tennis Federation, the DTB, said it is ready to offer him a job again. So talk about resuscitating a life. Unbelievable. And this is really interesting because these are important things in our lives. St. Nicholas is bringing Christmas magic to eastern Ukraine. Missiles can't stop the Ukrainian people call Magic Night or St. Nicholas Day. This year, St. Nicholas also headed to Kyiv train station and took a train to eastern Ukraine. Supported by UNICEF, he aims to bring joy to thousands of children in the war-torn region. And that is really so exciting because everybody needs that anyway. So really, really important. Bear with me a moment. Wanted to tell you about this. Evidently, there is a migrant crisis, a state of emergency in the border city of El Paso in Texas. Title 42 is a set of COVID-era restrictions on asylum seekers and is set to stay in place under the U.S. Supreme Court after the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Republican challenge. That means more problems for asylum seekers. So we'll have to see where all that goes. But it's something that you need to be aware of. And this is probably the most exciting thing that's happened in a very long time. Argentina's World Cup winners get a triumphant welcome home. It seems that after their World Cup triumph in Qatar, Argentina's national team have returned home and were greeted by fans in Buenos Aires. The team paraded the trophy in an open-top bus at thousands, literally thousands, assembled in the capital. It's unbelievable. The plane carrying the Argentine champions touched down in Buenos Aires at 2:30 in the morning local time. And It's just unbelievable. I saw it on the internet. The games were absolutely stupendous, and Lionel Messi, a national hero, as is the coach, Lionel Scaloni. They were the first to leave the plane with a World Cup trophy in Messi's hand. It is so emotional. It's unbelievable. The team walked down a red carpet to an open white double-decker bus painted with the words Campeones del Mundo, which means world champions, and three stars for the three World Cup titles won. One of them was in 1978, another in 1986, and the third in 2022. Unbelievable. So despite the late hour, literally thousands of fans had come to welcome their World Cup heroes home. At a distance of 5 kilometers away, the destination was the grounds of the Argentine Football Association, and everybody was already partying. It is unbelievable. You have never seen so many people come out in support of Messi and Diego Maradona, who was a previous winner. Before Messi, Maradona was the last Argentina captain to lift the World Cup in 1986. You have never seen throngs of people anywhere in the world as you have at this celebration of Argentina's win, the blue and white of the uniform is just absolutely breathtaking. And definitely a celebration by Argentina, and well-deserved, to say the least. Okay, let's look at some other things that you may find interesting. And this is really interesting. Evidently, with regard to China, more than 1 million could die from COVID in 2023. With crematoriums working 24/7 and 1.6 million predicted deaths, where is the Chinese government's medical response? Well, when China relaxes zero COVID policy at the start of December, international observers warned there would be mass outbreaks in the Chinese population, which, it was estimated, lacked sufficient herd immunity or vaccine protection. One statistical model published by the healthdata.org predicts that 300,000 people could die from COVID-19 infection by April of 2023, and 1.6 million people could die by the end of the year. Infections are steeply on the rise, and hospitals are overwhelmed. It's quite certain that the situation is spiraling out of control, at least in Beijing and other big cities, said Björn Alpermann, a sinologist at the University of Wolfsburg in Germany. On December 19, a prominent epidemiologist, Eric Feigl-Ding, tweeted that the situation was thermonuclear bad, quote unquote. Feigl-Ding predicted over 60% of China's and 10% of the Earth's population likely infected over the next 90 days. Deaths like in the millions, plural. And that's what needs to be understood. It's in the plural, in the millions. In scenes reminiscent of the early months of the pandemic in 2020, Feigl-Ding posted a video of what looks like an overcrowded hospital with patients lying close to each other on the floor. And other reports suggest morgues and crematoriums are overloaded with backlogs running into the thousands. The reports that crematoriums are working 24/7 are deeply disturbing, said Alpermann. It's not known how many people are currently infected with COVID-19 in China or the number of those who have recently died from the disease. Oliver Rutke, who lives in Beijing and is the chief representative of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, an independent political foundation affiliated with Germany's Greens Party, said it was impossible to know how severe the current COVID wave was by reading the official statistics. Judging strictly from personal evidence, scrolling through WeChat, which is social media, and having conversations with colleagues and friends, I reckon about one-third of the city is sick, one-third is taking care of the sick, and one-third simply doesn't dare to venture out. Alperman said that the Chinese government had more or less admitted that its statistics were artificially low when it said it would only count COVID deaths that had happened due to lung failure. And that's Alperman's personal assessment, but it suggests that those statistics tell only a partial truth. But the lack of accurate statistics about the current COVID situation in China makes predictions about deaths and illness difficult. There are so many moving parts and models, so there's a lot of guesswork. The subvariant Omicron BF7 circulating in China now isn't well studied, and we don't know how fast people will get boosters this winter, Alperman had said. So how are Chinese health authorities responding to the situation? Latka said that authorities had placed responsibility on individuals to keep safe. Quote, the official slogan these days is everybody's responsible for the prevention and control of the pandemic, he said. But the Chinese National Health Commission, the NHC, has initiated a large vaccination and booster campaign, especially for the elder and other high-risk groups. Many health experts outside China have been critical about the effectiveness of Chinese vaccines from Sinovac and Sinopharm compared to mRNA vaccines such as BioNTech, Pfizer, and Moderna jabs, and the NHC is only administering vaccines made in China. However, reports suggest they may include new nasal spray vaccines in the booster program. The hope is that the new vaccine types will reduce COVID transmission as well as the risk of severe COVID-19 symptoms. Quote, worries about grandparents and older parents are high, especially regarding family members in the countryside and remote provinces where intensive care units are rare or non-existent, said Rotke. Well, question is, what caused the latest COVID outbreak in China? Experts say that the current infection and death rates in China may be because the country has a lower level of population immunity than that in other countries. The Chinese government boasted they won a victory against COVID with their zero COVID strategy. For some time it looked that way in 2021, but with Omicron, the picture completely changed, said Alperman. China has pursued a zero COVID policy since the pandemic began. During zero COVID, the government implemented mass testing, imposed strict lockdowns, and quarantined those people with COVID-19 in special facilities. Now that it has relaxed its lockdown rules, the population has been going out, but with very little natural exposure to infection, especially the more contagious variants such as Omicron, because they were locked in for all that time. In any case, that is a theory you hear from health experts outside China. While rates of booster vaccine uptake are estimated to be low in China, especially among older people who have a high risk of developing severe symptoms, only about one-third of over 80s and two-thirds of over 60s have received their first booster shot, according to official data. In retrospect, it now looks like the Chinese government did not use the time during zero COVID to their own advantage to get vaccination rates as high as they should have been. They did not import more advanced mRNA vaccines or approve mRNA vaccines created in China. Well, the first of three waves, it seems that speaking at a conference in Beijing on December 17, Zun Yu Wu, a chief epidemiologist at the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention, said that the current outbreak would peak this winter and run in three waves for about 3 months. The modeling mentioned at the start of this article puts the potential death rate as high as 1.6 million people by the end of 2023. But that depends on whether COVID transmission can or will be contained with new lockdowns and by the success of vaccination programs. Quote, I'm worried about what happens once the current wave reaches the lesser developed parts of the country, especially in the western hinterland, said Ratzke. Whatever the exact figures, Chinese health authorities appear to be struggling to keep up with the spread of the disease, and that continues to, quote, cause concern outside of the country as well. So these are going to be major, major, major problems in China for sure. We'll have to see where all that goes. Bear with me a second. Now, let me quickly look here for a moment. All right, 1 second. All right, 1 minute here. Go back to our studio screen. Let's find here. Bear with me a moment. Okay, moving on to another page. All right, let me just see. Okay. This is really unbelievable, but this is the latest news from Putin. Putin is supporting a plan to increase the Russian armed forces to 1.5 million people. He said Russian President Vladimir Putin supported a proposal by Defense Minister to boost the Russian military by more than 30% on Wednesday, as he said Moscow needed to learn from and address the problems that it's facing in Ukraine. So that's the problem. So the way it is, Russia's defense minister proposes increasing the number of troops to 1.5 million. It's necessary to increase the number of armed forces to 1.5 million servicemen, including 695,000 contract soldiers, the defense minister Sergei Shoigu told Russian President Vladimir Putin, who, quote, agreed with the proposals at a defense meeting. Shoigu also proposed raising the age range for mandatory Russian military service to 21 to 30 compared to 18 to 27 at the moment. Well, reporters from France and Cat Television went to the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut, where they documented Ukrainian troops in front line trenches and city residents gathering to receive aid. Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu said on Wednesday that Moscow's forces waging a military campaign in Ukraine are facing the combined forces of the West, which has supplied Kyiv with arms and financial aid. In Ukraine, Russian servicemen are opposed to the combined forces of the West, Shoigu said during a meeting of Vladimir Putin and with his country's top military officers. So they're going to redo whatever they do, and Putin is going heavy, deeply heavy into, into fighting to defeat the Ukrainians. So we'll see where all that goes. Now let's go to the Americas. Evidently, in Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is set to return to office as president for the third time. But while Lula may be back, the country he's set to govern is far from united behind him. So pro-Bolsonaro farmer and a local minister of parliament who defends the outgoing president's track record on climate change and deforestation also shares his fears for the future of the country under a Lula presidency. So that's become one of the crises and that needs to be overcome by Lula if he wants to move the nation forward, because the nation is divided, and it's a major, major power, Brazil, and it needs to be find out what to do and to do it well. because it's going to be a real problem otherwise. Anyway, Musk says he'll resign as a Twitter CEO when he finds someone, quote, foolish enough to take the job, end quote. You know, billionaire Elon Musk said on Tuesday he will step down as chief executive of Twitter, Inc. once he finds a replacement, but will still run some key divisions of the social media platform. I will resign as CEO, he says, as soon as I find someone foolish enough to take the job. After that, I will just run the software and servers teams, Musk wrote on Twitter. Musk's $44 billion takeover of Twitter in October has been marked by chaos and controversy, with some investors questioning if he is too distracted to also properly run his electric vehicle automaker Tesla, Inc., in which he is personally involved in production and engineering. This is the first time that Musk has mentioned stepping down as chief of the social media network after Twitter users voted for him to resign in a poll which the billionaire launched on Sunday evening. So he wrote, I will resign as CEO as soon as I find someone foolish enough to take the job. After that, I will just run the software and servers teams. In the poll, 57.5% of around 17.5 million people voted yes. Musk has said on Sunday that he would abide by the results. He had not provided a time frame for when he will step down, and no successor has been named. So the poll results capped a whirlwind week that includes changes to Twitter's privacy policy and the suspension and reinstatement of journalists' accounts that drew condemnation from news organizations, advocacy groups, and officials across Europe. So Musk projected that Twitter's cash flow will break even in 2023. A Bloomberg reporter tweeted on Wednesday, citing comments made in a Twitter Spaces session. So Musk attributed the projection to cost-cutting measures he has undertaken at the social media platform recently, Bloomberg tweeted. Wall Street calls for Musk to step down has been growing for weeks, and recently even Tesla bulls have questioned his focus on the social media platform and how it might distract him from running the electric vehicle maker, which is really very important. So that is his background and moneymaker, to say the least. Now, let me just quickly... Bear with me a second here. I want to think what else we need to do here. One second here. Where is this? This is a frightening report. The United Nations issued a report that noted that more than 11,000 children were killed or maimed in Yemen civil war. More than 11,000 children are known to have been killed or maimed in Yemen civil war since it escalated nearly 8 years ago, the United Nations said on Monday. The true toll of this conflict is likely to be far higher, said the children's agency UNICEF, about the cancellation of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. So really frightening. So we'll see where all of this goes. 2.2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished. One quarter of them are aged under five, and most are at extreme risk from cholera, measles, and other vaccine-preventable diseases, UNICEF said. Yemen's war broke out in 2014 and quickly saw Iran-backed Houthi rebels seize the capital of Sana'a, prompting Saudi-led forces to intervene to prop up the government the following year. Hundreds of thousands have died since, either as a result of fighting or indirectly through unsafe drinking water, disease outbreaks, hunger, and other impacts. So the agency's latest numbers confirmed 3,774 child deaths between March 2015 and September of 2022. A UN-brokered truce lasted for 6 months until October 2nd, but warring parties then failed to agree on an extension. Since then, at least 62 children have been killed or wounded, said UNICEF. Well, the urgent renewal of the truce would be a positive first step that would allow critical humanitarian access. And so we'll see where all that goes. You know, the world just has statistics, but they don't have solutions, which is absolutely frightening. Really, it's just amazing. Okay. Israel is deporting a Palestinian activist by the name Salah Hamouri to France. Israel on Sunday deported a Palestinian lawyer and activist to France after claiming he has ties to a banned military group, drawing a rare condemnation from the French government. Well, the expulsion of Salah Hamouri underscored the fragile status of Palestinians in Israel and East Jerusalem, where most hold revocable residency rights but are not Israeli citizens. It also worsened a brewing diplomatic spat with France, which had repeatedly appealed to Israel not to carry out the expulsion. Quote, I'm happy to announce that justice has served today and the terrorist Salah Hamouri was deported from Israel. Israel's Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked had announced in a videotaped statement earlier on Sunday. The expulsion capped months of legal wrangling. Hamouri, who was born in Jerusalem but holds French citizenship, landed in Paris just before 10 o'clock local time in the morning wearing a black tracksuit and black and white keffiyeh or Palestinian headscarf around his neck. He was greeted by his wife and a group of supporters. Some hugged him and others clapped in support. Speaking to reporters, Hamouri accused Israel of cleansing, end quote, and said his deportation was meant to, quote, show the generations that nobody can resist Israel. He vowed to fight the order. Quote, I will continue to fight or to continue my right to resist against this occupation until I have the right to go back to my country, he said. Israel said that Hamoud is an activist in the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a group that has labeled a terrorist organization. He has worked as a lawyer for Adamir, a rights group that assists Palestinian prisoners that Israel has banned for alleged ties to the Palestine Liberation Front. It's, I think they're called the Palestine Liberation, I think it's simply called the Palestine Liberation Front. Anyway, he spent 7 years in prison after being convicted in an alleged plot to kill a prominent rabbi, was released in a 2011 prisoner swap with a Hamas militant group. He was not charged or convicted in the latest proceedings against him. Israel, however, claimed he continued his activities with the banned group, stripped him of residency, and placed him last March in administrative detention, a status that allows Israel to hold suspected militants 4 months at a time without changing them or putting them on. So that seems to be the crisis there. All right, let me just quickly look to see if we've got anything here. I'm not quite sure. I'll go to our studio screen. Bear with me here. I think we've covered everything. Well, what we need to cover is to issue a Chag Sameach Pesach. So a happy holiday for Passover. And many people will be celebrating Christmas pretty soon. So Merry Christmas and all the best that life has to offer for everyone who celebrates Christmas as well. And that's the story for us today. So what we'll do is we'll wish you a goodbye. There are about 20 minutes left, but we'll get going now because we still have a lot to do and a lot to cover. Take care. Be well. Bye. All right, let's just see here. Okay, let's just see where else we go here. I think we're fine. All right, so we're going to just simply say goodbye. Have a great day. We'll speak to you tomorrow. And I'm not quite sure who our guest will be tomorrow, but we'll figure out what to do then. Take care and be well and goodbye.